Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Christopher Wright DeRocher of the American Constitution Society, who assesses the threat posed to democracy by the Trump regime's defiance of the rule of law that's triggered a constitutional crisis. Aaron Ruggenberg of the New Republic, who discusses how Bernie Sanders is setting a good example for how the Democratic Party can become more effective in leading opposition to Trump's dismantling of democracy. And Bill Karam, executive director of the Pipeline Safety Trust, who talks about growing concern that Trump fossil fuel industry deregulation could lead to an increase in future oil and gas pipeline accidents. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a surprising move, the United States-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, the Kurdish army that has battled Islamic State fighters for a decade, signed a peace deal with the interim government in Damascus that took control of the country after its forces ousted dictator Bashar al-Assad last December. The deal did not spell out how the SDF will be merged with Syria's armed forces. The agreement between Syria's interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, and Kurdish commander General Mazlum Abdi, whose forces hold a quarter of the country's oil-rich northeast, established a framework for a unified state. The deal comes after 1,300 people were killed, including many civilians, in clashes between pro-government Islamist groups and remnants of Assad's loyalist army among the minority Alawite ethnic group. The Trump administration supported the agreement and is reassessing its policy towards Syria, including the future status of 2,000 U.S. troops based in northeast Syria, deployed there years ago to contain forces of the Islamic State, which has seen a recent upsurge in activity. In an ongoing conflict with the government of South Africa, the Trump regime has expelled Abraham Rasool, South Africa's ambassador to Washington, with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio accusing the envoy, a veteran of the anti-apartheid struggle, of hating America and Donald Trump. Neither Rubio nor the State Department gave an immediate explanation for the decision. However, Rubio referenced a right-wing internet story that cited a talk Rasool had given in an online webinar on March 14th, where he spoke about actions taken by the Trump administration, including attacks on civil rights laws and DEI, in the context of a future U.S. where white people would no longer be a majority. The Trump administration has repeatedly moved to isolate South Africa by cutting off aid and encouraging white Afrikaners, who are a small, privileged minority in South Africa, to apply for asylum in the U.S. Billionaire Elon Musk has accused his birth nation of having racist ownership laws relating to land reform legislation, and Trump has condemned South Africa's government for bringing a case before the International Court of Justice accusing Israel of genocide in its war in Gaza. American small farmers suffered a major economic blow when the U.S. Department of Agriculture abruptly froze more than $1 billion in funds for programs that provide fresh food for the nation's public schools and food banks. The canceled contracts come as small farmers had already committed funds to purchase seed and to plant crops to feed lower-income children and families. According to Barn Raiser Media, nearly one in five children in America live in households without consistent access to adequate food. School meals often play a critical role in providing food to students from low-income families, and free or low-priced school meal programs have been shown to increase students' achievement and attendance. Federal programs that enlisted farmers to supply nutritious foods and vegetables to local schools were launched by President Biden during the COVID pandemic, then extended. Indiana farmer Thomas Ike, a former teacher, had already paid $10,000 for seeds, fertilizer, and supplies when he was notified in early March that his USDA contracts were canceled. More than the lost revenue, Ike lamented the cuts are an attack against the food security of the most vulnerable age groups in our society. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump was sworn into office in January, his administration has repeatedly defied the rule of law and the U.S. Constitution's checks and balances on executive power. Trump and his top campaign contributor, billionaire Elon Musk, are attempting to eliminate entire federal agencies authorized and funded by Congress and fire hundreds of thousands of government workers. At the same time, the twice-impeached convicted felon has issued dozens of executive orders driven by a desire for revenge to punish journalists, media outlets, politicians, judges, law firms, corporate CEOs, universities, and anyone who Trump perceives as a political enemy. In a case that could deepen the constitutional crisis precipitated by Trump's continuing challenge to judicial branch authority, a federal judge has refused to lift his block on deportations of alleged Venezuelan-trained Aragua gang members to an El Salvador prison, dubiously ordered under authority of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act. In a March 24th hearing, lawyers representing the Trump regime refused to give Federal District Court Judge James Boasberg the times of departure of two government flights carrying the Venezuelan deportees on March 15th, stonewalling the judge's investigation into verifying that Trump officials had defied his explicit order for the planes to return to the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Christopher Wright DeRocher, Vice President for Program and Policy with the American Constitution Society. Here he assesses the threat posed to democracy by the Trump regime's authoritarian actions over the past 8 weeks, declaring that the U.S. is now in the midst of a constitutional crisis.
What is a constitutional crisis? I think in Trump 1.0, we certainly talked about it pretty frequently. In Trump 2.0, it seems to be sort of much more fast-tracked. They are not wasting any time in terms of grabbing as much power as they can in the executive. And while I think some folks, especially some institutions, have been slow to sort of recognize that we are in a constitutional crisis, there's been a lot of warning about we are approaching a constitutional crisis. I think that the fact of the matter is we are firmly within that crisis. And I say that because what you have seen the Trump administration do is through executive orders and executive actions starting on January 20th, day one of this administration, over the course of the past 2.5 months or so, has been a systemic weakening of the foundations of our constitutional order, attempts to usurp power from the legislative branch, attempts to redefine what the law means, absent sort of any underlying justification. And I think most concerningly, instances where the Trump administration has actively ignored or disrespected courts who have attempted to keep them in check. And I think the most obvious example of that is the situation in which a judge in the Southern District of New York issued an order telling the Trump administration in no uncertain terms that it should not send alleged terrorists to Venezuela using the justification of the Alien Enemies Act, which is an act that was passed in 1798, so nearly 230 years ago, a relatively obscure law that had never been used in this manner. The administration essentially flouted that order. And that in and of itself was a deeply disconcerting moment in sort of the history of our democracy.
Thank you for that summary, Christopher. There are more than 100 pending lawsuits now attempting to reverse Trump administration executive orders and other actions defying the U.S. Constitution and rule of law. Many of these cases may, in the end, be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is dominated by a 6-3 supermajority of conservative justices who may, as they did in providing Trump with absolute immunity from criminal prosecution, they could side with Trump and tear down some of the essential democratic guardrails established in the U.S. Constitution. And then, of course, you have another scenario where they uphold the Constitution, these justices, a majority of them, and Trump ignores it. Then we are certainly in a very different place. We don't have a lot of time to get into this, but maybe paint a picture of the crises that we may face in just a matter of weeks here.
You know, those two opposing scenarios are both equally frightening. There is a concern that this Supreme Court could rubber stamp the Trump administration's actions in these cases and essentially sort of write itself and write the remainder of the judiciary sort of out of the picture, basically saying it doesn't matter what Congress does, it doesn't matter what the judiciary says. If the president says it, then it is the law. In that case, we are looking at an authoritarian dictatorship. There's no two ways about it. It's a hard thing to argue against if the Supreme Court does not provide any checks. You know, the other concern, obviously, is if the Trump administration ignores a Supreme Court that strikes him down. And, you know, there's an adage that courts have no armies and they have no money. And so really all they have is their legitimacy and the respect of the other two branches. The question is, will the Supreme Court blink? Will the Trump administration blink? And will there be sufficient outcry if the court goes along with these Trump administration actions, or will they be met with apathy? That will determine sort of how much further these power grabs can go. One of my biggest concerns is that in an effort to maintain their legitimacy, both the Supreme Court and the lower courts, afraid that the Trump administration will flout adverse decisions, will go along with them just to sort of maintain at least the appearance of their continued legitimacy and their continued power. It is certainly a tipping point. Just because we're in a constitutional crisis now, which we are, doesn't mean that it can't be a much worse constitutional crisis. And so we should all be watching closely to see how lower courts handle those 100 plus cases, as you said, and how the Supreme Court ultimately responds to some of the most sort of egregious power grabs by the Trump administration.
That was Christopher Wright DeRocher, Vice President for Program and Policy with the American Constitution Society. Find more news and commentary on the Trump regime's threat to democracy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Although it may have been slow to start, opposition to Donald Trump's implementation of the right-wing Project 2025 blueprint for eliminating critical government programs in order to fund major tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, is growing, with dozens of protests in the streets across the country virtually every day, long before the Republican-led House approved a continuing budget resolution that cuts $13 billion in domestic spending, later approved by the Senate, with help from Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Many voters opposed to the Trump agenda were furious at Democrats for not more aggressively opposing Trump and Elon Musk's demolition of dozens of federal agencies, the mass firing of government workers, and threats to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. As Trump opponents gear up for a national day of protest on April 5th, Vermont's independent Senator Bernie Sanders and New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez launched a national Fight Oligarchy tour that's drawn tens of thousands of angry voters to rallies opposing Trump and in support of popular progressive policies like Medicare for All. Your reporter spoke with Aaron Regenberg, a contributing editor at The New Republic and senior climate policy counsel at Public Citizen. Here he talks about the need to replace Democratic Party leaders like Chuck Schumer while applauding the example set by Sanders and AOC for energizing democracy defenders in the face of Trump's authoritarian administrative coup.
We need to take action to direct people's attention towards this reality of what they are doing, of how they are hurting people, of how their agenda is destroying lives and programs that people, that regular working people rely on. And if you are just giving up on every fight, like, you know, Chuck Schumer just demonstrated, if you're giving up every opportunity to take a stand to draw attention, because conflict is what draws attention, one, you're not going to succeed in bringing down the approval rating, because people are not going to be hearing the reality. And two, I mean, the other piece is, like, we're dealing with an authoritarian takeover, right? Like, we can't actually just wait. Even if their strategy, like in that long, medium, long-term vision were true, which we just described it's not, but even if it were, like, we are losing things now that we can't gain, right? The budget that Chuck Schumer rolled over and gave Democratic votes to pass, it doesn't just cut essential services, it also gives crazy additional powers to the Trump administration to continue shredding the rule of law and the Constitution in its executive overreach. And so, you know, in so many ways, the Democratic Party leadership has not been meeting the moment. I think that is why you see those low approval ratings and anger that we've seen. And every poll I see where Democrats are doing badly, the number one issue, it seems, that our party is failing on is people saying, I don't believe that they are going to fight for me. That is overwhelmingly what the problem is. And Americans want a fighter, right? That is one of the reasons that Trump is where he is, because say what you will about him, people are like, well, he's going to fight. And when the Democratic Party keeps rolling over and caving and demonstrating that even when the stakes are this high, we're not going to put up a fight, like, how can we expect people to feel confident that we're going to stand up and fight for them? And that, I think, is the core of why what Bernie Sanders is doing right now is so important and so essential. And just, you know, he's laying out the blueprint for what every Democratic leader needs to be doing for the next 2 and 4 years if we're going to have a shot of staving off a total fascist takeover.
I guess the question is, many of the Democrats, including Chuck Schumer, who people are calling to step down from a leadership position in the Democratic Party, they claim, well, we're in the minority. We don't have any power. What can we do? That's the message from Chuck Schumer. So with all these people showing up at these rallies, what's the vision for the future that is capturing so much support and attention by people across the country that Bernie Sanders and AOC are generating? Where is this headed?
I want to talk about that. First, I just really want to briefly touch on that there's nothing we can do message that we have heard from folks like Schumer and others at the top of the party. And it is so infuriating. I mean, have we ever heard Mitch McConnell, when Republicans are in the minority, did they ever say, well, we don't have any leverage, there's nothing we can do? Never, right? It is impossible to even imagine Mitch McConnell under a Biden or Obama presidency whipping Republicans in order to support a Democratic budget. It's just inconceivable. That is why I think so many across the party are calling on Chuck Schumer to pass the torch, to step down. We need new leadership now who, whether it's cowardice or incompetence, people who have the ability and the sort of strategic analysis that reflects our current reality to lead our party right now. When we do have leverage, and part of that leverage, as you described, is as we're seeing that nearly 100,000 people over the last couple weeks coming out and saying, we are not going to stand for oligarchy. And I think the vision that is being laid out in these events and rallies, it's not a new vision, right? Like, I don't think things are complicated. We've had this going back to FDR. When the Democratic Party has been successful, it has been when we have said, we're the party of regular people, and we are standing up to the oligarchs, to the billionaires, to the folks that are in so many ways taking away what we need to live good lives. And there are reasons, I think, that Democratic elites have not been willing to embrace that basic message of economic populism because it goes against their donors, right? It goes against some of their core constituencies. But it is time for us to chuck out those core constituencies that have led us to this disaster and get back to our Democratic roots, which is to say we're the party of regular people and we're going to go up against those elites, which, you know, by the way, Donald Trump represents the epitome of, right? Him and his billionaire cabinet they say that they are taking on elites, and it is utter BS. They are the elites that are destroying our society, but we need to actually have ways of demonstrating that to people and getting that message in front of people.
That was Aaron Ruggenberg, a contributing editor at the New Republic and senior climate policy counsel with Public Citizen. Find a link to Ruggenberg's article titled "Bernie Sanders is Showing Democrats How It's Done" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It seems that no part of the federal government is exempt from Donald Trump and Elon Musk's Doge chainsaw that's cutting federal agency budgets and firing staff and using that money to fund huge tax cuts, mostly benefiting the rich. The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA, is a tiny federal agency under the Department of Transportation tasked with ensuring the safety of the country's 3 million miles of gas, oil, and other pipelines. Due to the Trump-Musk-Doge cuts, more than half of PHMSA's senior leadership are leaving the agency. This comes as 2023 through 2024 was the deadliest two-year period for pipeline accidents in over a decade. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bill Karam, executive director of the Pipeline Safety Trust, a nonprofit based in Bellingham, Washington, that was established in the wake of a gasoline explosion on the Olympic Pipeline that killed three children in 1999. The trust serves as a national watchdog on both companies and regulators. Here, Karam talks about the inclusion or not of the odorant mercaptan in gas pipelines that can warn nearby residents of leaks. He also addresses the problems that already exist with PHMSA and how the situation will likely get far worse under the Trump administration plan to deregulate the energy industry and expand pipeline construction.
The odorant is required in distribution systems, which are the system you're referring to that bring gas service into homes and businesses. And that's generally a low pressure system, as opposed to the transmission pipelines, which are the large diameter, high pressure pipelines that move the methane over long distances. Odorant is not required to be in those pipelines by and large. There's some exceptions. Some states have required them to be in their intrastate gas transmission pipelines. There's a couple reasons for that. One is that leakage, the kinds of leaks that do threaten a home where methane will leak and travel underground and gather in an enclosed space and eventually ignite, that's less likely to happen on a high pressure transmission pipeline than it is on the lower pressure distribution systems. Those distribution systems are closer to homes generally, where they pose more of a threat. Mercaptan does have a slight corrosive effect on pipelines, and that can be mitigated against. So they generally don't require it in those transmission pipelines. We would like to still see it required in transmission pipelines, but there are reasons why they don't require it.
You said you'd like to see it. Do you think it's a safety issue?
Yes. When I say it's less likely to happen, it certainly is versus a distribution system, but that doesn't mean it never happens.
There was a big explosion of a gas pipeline a few years ago in West Virginia, which created this gigantic fireball.
There was another large release just maybe a month ago in West Virginia, a couple of years ago in Virginia. They don't tend to like have slow leaks over time, which is where the odorant can be helpful. It tends to be a rupture all at once, and the odorant is not necessarily helpful in that situation.
Bill Karam, has the Trump administration taken any action regarding pipeline safety?
As of now, there are no leak detection requirements on gas pipelines. Operators are required to do patrols periodically, but most of those don't involve leak detection equipment. And the ones that do involve leak detection equipment, there's no standards as to how sensitive or accurate or reliable that equipment needs to be. We have no idea really how much methane is leaking from these pipelines or emitting from these pipelines. Odorant is a way to let people know that there is some gas coming out of the pipeline. As you're well aware, methane is such a potent greenhouse gas that we really need to know. And so the Biden administration and in the final weeks of the administration, they finally put out a final rule about leak detection equipment and set standards on it and how often operators needed to be surveying their pipelines and how quickly they needed to repair the leaks that they found. None of that exists right now. That rule was pulled from the Federal Register in the first weeks of the Trump administration, and we have no idea of when that may return, but it leaves a big hole in pipeline safety and pipelines' impact on climate change.
And what about cuts to PHMSA, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration?
The retirement package, the fork in the road offer, and the termination of the probationary employees, all of that is a concern at the agency. And it's especially a concern at PHMSA because they are a notoriously underfunded, under-resourced agency. There are more miles of pipeline in America than miles of paved road. And overseeing all of that is this tiny, tiny agency in the Department of Transportation. 600 employees, only about half of those are dedicated to pipelines. So we're talking about 300 employees with over 3 million miles of pipelines that they're trying to oversee. They don't have enough resources, they don't have enough staff. So every bit of that agency is really geared around safety. So they've said, oh, the inspectors are not subject to this because we don't want to jeopardize safety by terminating inspectors. But sure, you have the inspectors, but you also have the accident investigation team, you have the research and development department. They're all focused on safety, and the loss of any of them is going to be an impact to safety.
That was Bill Karam, Executive Director of the Pipeline Safety Trust. Learn more about the trust and concern that Trump fossil fuel industry deregulation will lead to an increase in future pipeline accidents by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, KGNU in Denver, Colorado, KFUG in Crescent City, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.